Hello and welcome. My name is Nick Davies and I'm a programme director here at the Institute for Government. On behalf of the Institute and Revolut, thank you very much for joining us for this discussion on what the government can do to tackle fraud. This is a particularly timely discussion given that the government's anti-fraud summit took place last week, though given that fraud accounts for the best part of half of all victim-reported crime and only one in a thousand cases results in a charge or summons, it's a critical discussion to be had at any time. A wide range of organisations have responsibility for tackling fraud, including the Home Office, the National Crime Agency, the Serious Fraud Office, City of London Police, Metropolitan Police Service, Financial Conduct Authority, and the National Cyber Security Centre. However, there are challenges about coordination, capacity, and capability. So what can the government do to help tackle fraud? How can coordination among the various agencies with responsibility be improved? And what steps could be taken to help improve detection and prosecution rates? To discuss these issues and more, I'm delighted to be joined by Emily Thornberry, the Shadow Attorney General, Francesca Carlisi, the CEO of Revolut UK, Nick Stapleton, co-presenter of the BBC Scam Interceptors, and Adrian Searle, director of the National Economic Crime Centre. Each of our speakers will make opening remarks. I'll then ask a few follow-up questions before opening it up to questions from the audience. If you have a question for any of the panellists and you're in the room, I'll ask you to raise your hand. Or if you're watching online, you can submit them using the online Slido Q&A function and you can start submitting those questions now. We will be live tweeting from the @IFGEvents Twitter account, and I'd encourage all those watching to tweet along using #IFGPublicServices. Right. Without further ado, I'm going to hand over to Emily Thornberry.
I'd really like to say thank you for inviting me. And what a pleasure it is to be on a panel of such experts and in front of, from what I hear about you, a somewhat intimidating audience of expertise. And in this beautiful building, in this great institution and this organisation that has such a huge impact on the way that we govern. So thank you. And also, thank you for inviting me to talk about one of my favourite subjects. I have been looking into the issue of fraud for some time now, and I have been struck, actually, by a couple of things, which is, you know, I've had so many discussions with different organisations about fraud, about what we could do, about what we should do, about how we could move forward, about what the challenges are, about what we could have as a strategy. And I'm thinking, presumably the government's having conversations like this as well. And if the government is having conversations like this as well, why aren't they doing anything about it? Or why is what they're doing so just not enough? There's so much thought going on and people have so many different ideas. I mean, as I say, I've spoken to Francesca's colleagues in Revolut. I've spoken to all the banks who've kind of come in to see me, and you know, they are absolutely on this issue, you know, particularly, frankly, because, you know, in the near future they will be legally responsible for ensuring that any victims of crime who have been persuaded to put money out of their bank accounts quickly on a push payment system, they will have to reimburse them. And so they definitely want to look creatively at what we could do in order to be able to protect the individuals and the banks. Because even if the bank does repay, the individuals themselves still has an impact on them in terms of their confidence. They will think twice about using their bank account again. It will have a chilling effect on the economy. And they look around and they say, well, actually, you know, there's a great deal that needs to be done in relation to social media. And of course, what we have is an online, a voluntary online charter from social media. But, you know, like, just read it. You know, it is not sufficient for the task, and much more needs to be done. And surely the government hear this. Surely the government have been told this. I don't underestimate the lobbying powers of the banks. So why is not more being done in relation to that? It does seem to me that these things are there. I think that I've spoken to Nick, I mean, and Nick has got some great ideas, which, most of which I've stolen, and I've, you know, and I've been you know, pushing and saying, you know, for example, why is it that you can buy a British phone number and be able to use it from some, you know, factory in, I don't know where, in India, you know, where you are putting out like hundreds, thousands of phone calls, just trying to catch an elderly person at home in the afternoon who answers the phone because they think that they're answering the phone to a Brit. Now, actually, they're answering the phone to a fraudster. You know, why are we allowing that to happen? Why is that allowed? You know, and again, I mean, you know, I can look at this from opposition. Why is the government not thinking of these, you know, sorts of things? And I know that on Scambusters, you know, there are many, many different examples all the time, and but not just a kind of fraud is hard. Oh, what do we do? Hey, it's just one of those things, isn't it? No, you know, we need to be able to fight back, and we need to be imaginative and on the front foot. And I mean, you know, and when you look at what the government has done, I mean, inexplicably, we've talked about the, you know, the fraud conference yesterday, but when I asked the Home Office, you know, if they had invited India or the Philippines or Indonesia or Nigeria or Ghana or South Africa, they weren't even invited to London. But we know that so much fraud is international, and we know that actually a lot of these kind of organized scams are based in countries such as those. We know that when they were negotiating the Indian trade deal, they didn't even talk about fraud. I mean, why are we not talking about international work when it comes to, you know, when it comes to deals on trade? It's quite possible to have a chapter on security, and part of that should be making sure that agencies work together in order to be able to fight fraud. And when I speak to Adrian and his various colleagues, you know, from the different agencies whose responsibility it is to tackle fraud, you know, there's prosecutors in the Crown Prosecution Service, or when I've spoken to City of London, you know, they're all working really hard and they try their utmost to coordinate. But, you know, I have to say what strike, and I applaud the work of NEC and the leadership that they show. But then you think, why isn't, I mean, they're making all these efforts. Why is there no effort being made across government to work in a more cohesive way? Why is there no coordination across government? In the end, the amount of money we lose as a country to fraud is the equivalent of the amount of money we spend on the National Health Service every year, plus another 25%. I mean, really? You know, and it's 40% of crime. Only 1% of the police budget is spent on fraud. How can we just, and I think it's an ideal 21st century crime in some ways, because what's going on is that, you know, it's a 21st century crime in that people just go, oh, well, the state can't deal with it. It's too hard. Like climate change, like, you know, all the big issues, somehow or other we can't deal with it. Yes, we can, but we have to keep changing, because the fraudsters, the moment we close one door, they will open another one. And we need to have, you know, talented, imaginative people like the ones on this panel to be there at the forefront, working with each other and working with government, who really does have their ears open, and make sure that we're on our toes and we're doing the right thing and we fight back and we stop. As I said to Adrian yesterday, you know, we don't allow ourselves as a country to be like lying on our tummy, wiggling our legs in the air, going, yeah, yeah, come and get us. Like, why not? Why can't we be a victim of fraud? No, we need to make ourselves a bit less digestible. We need to make it a bit harder for people to defraud people in the UK and let them move elsewhere.
Thank you, Emily. Francesca, I'm going to come to you next.
All right. Now, thank you, and thank you for having me. It's really a pleasure to be here and talk about this very important topic. And I have a lot of, it resonates a lot of the things you mentioned. So I represent today here Revolut in the UK. Revolut is a fintech company, maybe some of you know. And I must say, we are best known, I think, for digital propositions and from, and really strive for, has been historically about giving people empowerment with their money, and we want to be the best place for people to manage their money responsibly. The thing that is probably a little bit less well known, although it's happening at the same level of priorities, that we also want to be a leader in the fight against fraud and financial crime more in general. It has been a top priority for the company since a while, and before even I joined. And to give a sense of the extent of what I'm really talking about, to put in numbers, we employ today 4,000 people in financial crime. This is kind of half of our workforce globally. Only last year, we kind of kind of, we're able to stop $500 million worth of fraud for our customers. Now, $500 million is like a big numbers, but in reality, if we think it's only about, it's for one company, this gives a sense of what's the scale of the issues that we are kind of facing today. And the way we do it is also using the most kind of advanced technologies, because that's what we know how to do best. We like to say we use AI to fight AI, mostly because we are realizing, being on the trenches every day, that the problem of fraud is becoming more sophisticated. So effectively, you need to kind of also use sophisticated tools to fight effectively, because otherwise, we're going nowhere. So that's why we're here today, and I'm very happy to have an open and proper discussion about the topic.
Brilliant. Thank you, Francesca. Nick, I'm going to come to you next.
Thank you. And thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. It's a great pleasure to get to talk to a room full of people who are interested in this and with such an esteemed panel. The first thing I want to talk about, I think, is just the scale of what we're up against here. So my personal experience of this, in the last 3 years, I've monitored one particular scam call centre, which is based in Calcutta, in India, in a place called Sector 5, which is effectively the Silicon Valley of scam call centres. It's where the vast majority of the scam call operations who are ringing the UK out of that country are based. That call centre is capable, thanks to the technology which exists, to make what are called robocalls, which is when you receive a call out of the blue, a robotic voice talks to you and delivers you a message. That single call centre is capable of making 100,000 calls to the UK in a day. And they work 6 day weeks, so that's 600,000 calls a week, just less than 30 million a year, coming out of one scam call centre. In the course of making now 3 series of scam interceptors, we've documented about 30 or 40 of those. Jim Browning, the ethical hacker and YouTuber who we work with on the show, he's documented over 100 in the time that he's been doing this. That is just out of India and Pakistan alone. So the scale of that is absolutely mind-boggling. If you imagine one call centre is capable of doing that many calls, imagine how many others there are. We only get to see a drop in the ocean of this. That's the reality of the situation. The second example is a more modern take on the scam, which is something called pig butchering. And it's an increasingly popular type of scam, which begins with, what a horrible name, I know. It begins with what seems like a romantic approach, usually on a dating app or some sort of instant messaging like WhatsApp or Telegram. And it then leads to a cryptocurrency investment scam. Mm. And the reason that I want to talk about this particular scam center is the sheer size of it. So this one was based in the UAE, in Dubai, and just outside the city, and seemingly run by Chinese organized crime. This center had 4 high-rise buildings where the people who worked for them lived and worked, each of which we worked out with Jim Browning had about 250 people working in it. So they had almost 1,000 employees, we think. They were so big and they were using so much bandwidth that they ran out of internet. So what they did was they bought a flatbed truck with a 5G mast on the back of it and parked it outside their office so they could have enough internet. That is the amount of money that you're talking about that these people have. And the fascinating thing about what they do, and the really worrying thing about it, is that they are not limited by language. All of their scams are run inside auto-translation apps like a thing called Hello World. You can effectively bake in your instant messaging account to that app, and you can use it to contact any victim anywhere in the world. You can employ people speaking one language and have them talking to victims speaking another entirely, because the auto-translation just happens within the app. Their window of opportunity in terms of victims is the entire world. And that is what leads to the kind of losses that Emily has just outlined in her speech there. The amount of money that we're losing to this is absolutely staggering and just completely beyond whatever you see regularly quoted by the likes of UK Finance. They sometimes say losses to scams are about $1 billion or $1.2 billion a year. Research by Canada Life last year found it to come out about $17 billion. And that was from talking to British people, they found 1 in 2 had either been spoken to by a scammer or had been a victim of a scam themselves, and that 3.6 million of those had lost money. Average loss is about £4,000. That's not to all fraud, that is just to scams. £17 billion a year. That's what we spend on policing. It's 4 times what we spend on prisons. It is an astronomical amount of money. And I think if we're going to fix this problem, there's 3 things that we need to do. And I welcome the government's new Stop Think Fraud campaign. I do think this is a good thing. But talk about after the horse has bolted. He's in the south of France. He's retired. He's got a villa and a pool. It's long, long, long overdue. we need to centralise our anti-fraud approach. I think we need a new government department who are in charge of essentially taking control of this. I know that there is a change that's been made with their new fraud policy, which is going to see it more centralised, but I think part of the issue is there's too many different places to report for victims as well. So if it's an email you receive, you go to the National Cybersecurity Centre. If it's a text, you go to 7726. I just think we need one place for all of this to happen, to collate and centralise our approach. But more importantly, the issue of technology that I've just described, which has created this enormous scale of scams happening, that is caused by a failure of education. We've essentially got multiple generations of people at the moment who do not know what the norms of modern digital banking are and who do not know what normal practices of large tech companies are. If we could close that gap, it would essentially close this open goal for scammers that already exists. But the very difficult thing about that when it comes to scams is latency. We're always trying to fight against an enemy that is constantly moving, constantly changing. So I think we need to start teaching this in schools, and we need to clue up generation upon generation from the absolute youngest age imaginable, and essentially try and create a population of people who are far better defended against scams than what we have now. Because the most difficult thing, as I say, is just that time that it takes before we're able to get the information out into the world. If you've got a population of people who are already prepared for the red flags, already financially literate about this kind of thing, we would be much better protected, we would lose much less money. And lastly, I think we need to look at the technological solutions that are available and actually enact them, because at the moment we're not doing that. Currently, we've got legitimate businesses with overseas call centres who are perfectly allowed to spoof UK numbers when they're ringing into the UK. We should be licensing that.
That's right.
If we say to those overseas call centres that are being run by legitimate businesses, pay Ofcom for the right to do this, we'll create a database, and anyone outside that is banned, you would stop 95% of bank impersonation scams tomorrow. Because all those scam call centres who do that would have to find a new way to get in touch with those most vulnerable people who they try and reach, which is using spoofed UK numbers to ring UK landlines. You could even, if you wanted to take a slightly softer approach, just test it on landlines first and protect the most vulnerable people first and see how it works. Because we know scammers will, of course, move on and they will start, for example, spoofing mobile numbers, which costs a little bit more money. But then you have to go to the mobile operators and say, can you stop this at source, please? There's another difficulty with that in terms of people roaming who are actually outside the UK, but the mobile operators, again, can be on top of that. I think it's a national scandal that we have not been more on top of this. We haven't actually enacted any of these things already. Because you have to bear in mind, the financial loss is one thing, but we're talking about an emotional and psychological toll on some of the most vulnerable people in our society that goes far, far beyond that.
Nick, thank you. Adrian.
Thank you.
Yeah, so I'm director of the National Economic Crime Centre, and I'll explain in a little bit what that's about. But it is great to be here, great to be able to talk to all of you, and in particular, great to be on this panel and to hear the sort of impassioned views of colleagues on the panel. And obviously, there's lots of things that have been surfaced just in the last 10 minutes that at certain points I'd be very happy to try and explain some of the responses to. I should say, though, I'm not here to represent government. I'm here to represent the National Economic Crime Centre, and I'll talk about what we're doing in partnership with colleagues in the Home Office and others in government. So for those of you who don't know, the NEC was established back in 2018, and it was responding to the challenge that has been articulated around the coordination of in particular, the operational response to economic crime, so not just fraud, wider economic crime. It's a multi-agency unit housed in the National Crime Agency. So within the unit, we have representation from the likes of HMRC, recently from Ofcom, from the City of London Police, Financial Conduct Authority. So a range of agencies are coming together under the umbrella of the NEC to determine what we can do together to impact the economic crime threat. And more recently, we've been focused on the fraud threat. We've had a very key role working with colleagues in the Home Office to help shape the new national fraud strategy. And so for those of you who aren't aware of the strategy, it emerged recently, and it has three fundamental pillars to it. And I will, if it's okay, talk a little bit about them, because I think they start to reflect and pick up on some of the challenges that have been surfaced by other colleagues on the panel. So one of those pillars is the pursue pillar. So that's the work of law enforcement to arrest, prosecute, disrupt the activities of the fraudsters. And again, when it's the right time, I can talk a lot more about what we're doing in that space. The second pillar is empowering the public. So this is how, in particular on some of your comments, Nick, this is how we work to help inform the public as to what they can do to help protect themselves, and also how we work better with victims of frauds to help them through their experience and help them avoid becoming victims again. And the third pillar, and for me the most important pillar, is the what I call the stop and block pillar. So this is where we work with industry to design out fraud, because ultimately, again, pick up on comments, it's the technology that's enabling this fraud, and it's how do we work, for me the key question is how do we work with the technology providers to stop the frauds getting to the victims in the first place. And there's work that's going on with the telco sector, we've been working a lot with the banks, and increasingly, and I recognise the point that Emily's making about the social media companies, we are increasingly now working with the social media companies to try and design out fraud. And I can go into a lot of detail about any of those elements, you know, as the conversation progresses.
Brilliant, thank you. I'm now going to ask the panellists a few questions before coming to audience questions. So if you're in the audience, do think about them. And if you're watching online, do keep submitting them. Emily, I wanted to come to you first on that question of kind of centralisation and coordination. So as you said, there's kind of work that's underway by the agencies themselves to coordinate more effectively. But you know, if Labour is the next government, what could a Labour government do to facilitate even greater coordination and collaboration? And what do you think of Nick's idea for more centralisation?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is something that needs to be looked at, and there needs to be recognisably people within government whose responsibility it is to ensure that where we need to make changes, those changes are made and they're driven through. And as I say, I come across people so often who either have great ideas, or people within agencies who, with a bit of warming up, will say, it would be quite nice to be able to do this. You know, and it's like, yeah, okay, let me just take, I'll make a note of that. You know, and it's just like, it's as if there hasn't been this effort, I'm afraid, to do. I mean, I hear, you know, the fraud strategy is great, it's great, as far as it goes. And to a certain extent, I'm sorry, that's kind of like what one would say in relation to an awful lot of government initiatives at the moment. You know, it's great so far as it goes, but it doesn't go the whole journey. It takes the first three steps, but it's actually quite a long journey. It needs to do more than that. So yes, fine, as a direction of travel, fine. And actually, maybe it is something to build on, but it definitely needs building on. There definitely needs more work doing. And as I say, in order for it to be done effectively, I think we need to have a look across the piece. And, you know, let me just say about the fraud strategy, I mean, one of my criticisms of it, not just that it doesn't go far enough, but it also, whilst it talks about the fraud against individuals, which is the thing that which all gets all of us and is gut-wrenching and awful, but actually, I mean, fraud is also a threat to us and as a nation, as an economy, because of the amount of fraud that is going on against businesses. You know, payroll fraud, people trying to buy things and you know, giving money over to fraudsters and never getting the goods, you know, how that undermines our businesses. And also people, we know that once people have been defrauded, or a business has been defrauded, or somebody buying from a business has been defrauded, they will think twice, three times before using. You know, it has a chilling effect. And then fraud against government departments, you know, again, it needs to be much better coordinated. We need to be able to look at best practice, where things work and where things don't. And don't even get me started on some of the fraud that has happened that, you know, there has been a great deal of publicity about going on during the pandemic. I mean, what was going on there? So, yes, we do need to have it centrally coordinated, I think, in order to make sure, as I say, that we are gathering in as many good ideas as possible and implementing them as fast as possible and making sure, because we're all of goodwill, we just need to have it kind of pulled together.
Adrian, I wanted to come just to you on that kind of centralisation and coordination point. It was really great to hear about the work that is happening so far. What are the major barriers to even greater collaboration and coordination between the very long list of agencies that have responsibility for this?
If I may, I just would like to say a little bit about the complexity of the problem we're facing. I think because we can jump to the sense that, you know, I don't know, one single agency can solve this problem. But I think the reality is, and again, panellists have touched on this, you know, fraud is multifaceted. It has lots of different shapes and sizes. There's public sector fraud, there's fraud against business, there's fraud against individuals. Within those categories, there's then lots of different types of frauds. And I think we because that complexity of the threat, it's almost inevitable that some of the response will also be, to an extent, not as simple as people would hope it could be, because the threat is complex. Also, when I, in particular, focus on fraud against businesses and individuals, you know, we recognise that the frauds are happening at the local level, the regional level, the national level, and the international level. So again, you can't necessarily bring all that under one entity you have to work those bits of the collective system better together. So that's what we're very focused on at the moment, is building that national, regional, local, certainly from a law enforcement perspective, response to fraud. And so that's the work of the NEC in close partnership with City of London Police. And we're building a new intelligence function, which means that we can draw intelligence from all the different agencies, from the private sector. We have GCHQ now in the mix, so we can understand better what the threat is and then better target the resources we have collectively against the key components of that threat.
May I also, because I don't want to be unfair, I mean, I think it's not just law enforcement. You know, it is also about disruption, which is such an important part of this, which is, you know, they talk about, it's horrible, another horrible phrase, the kill chain. You know, you have to look at where the fraud is and just cut it off, start closing down bank accounts and going to people, yeah, go on, come and talk to us. Why have you got, well, tell us about this bank account. They'll never come. You know, but start doing that much more, and we need to have the information coming from all sources in order to be able to work that out.
So I totally agree with that.
Yeah.
And we are doing work with partners across the private sector as well. So we are looking at the fraud end-to-end journey.
Yes.
And we're trying to work out where are the key intervention points where we can make the biggest difference. Mm. And we're working that through with colleagues in the banking sector, but also the telco sector, and now increasingly the social media sector. Yes. So there's another part of the NEC, which is our public-private partnership function. You know, under that sort of governance structure, we are, you know, bringing people together to have these conversations, identify these intervention points, and take action. So just to give you an example, we worked very closely in the past with the telco sector on things like Spam Shield, where they put in place technology to try and reduce the SMS text messages that we're all getting. There is further work to do, and sorry, diverting a little bit onto your point, Nick, about CLI spoofing. Now, there is work to be done by the telco sector in terms of changing the infrastructure, and that is happening over time, but it's going to take time to get the right digital infrastructure in place, which will reduce the threat of, in particular, mobile phones being used to spoof UK numbers from overseas. But in addition to that work, we're also now working with the telcos for them to share intelligence with us to help us take law enforcement action. So in the last couple of months, we've had, I think it's now 30 referrals coming to us from the telco sector, which we're then sharing into wider law enforcement to take action against. So absolutely by your point, Emily, that this is about working with the private sector, it's not just about law enforcement. Mm. And that is one of the key remits of the NEC, is to bring those component parts of our system together better.
On that question of opportunities to intervene, Francesca, you mentioned that Revolut had stopped £500 million worth of fraud. I wanted to hear about Revolut's views on the newly published draft legislation that the government has put out, which will allow banks to slow down payments processing when there are reasonable grounds to suspect fraud. Is that going to help?
Okay, so let's say these early days, we are reviewing it with our teams and so on. However, in principle, I think it's a step that we welcome and that we think will help. Potentially, because clearly it's a massive step. Okay, we do recognise that actually it's a big change in a world that's moving faster all the time. Slow it down. It's a big statement, right? So, in general, we do welcome it and we think it will help. However, there are a couple of things that should be considered to avoid unintended consequences of this, right? So, first is we need to be aware that this will frustrate customers. It's our job as banks and financial institutions to try to manage expectations, but it might trigger some frustration that we see coming up on the other side, or complaints and things like that. I think second is what would be very important is that this is coupled with other pieces of initiatives that will help us make the most of these 3 days that we have. So what I mean is the following. So even if we slow down a payment, and even if you're able to manage the expectation of the customer, that in most cases doesn't think it's been the victim of a fraud. Yet, if we don't have access to data, for example, across sectors, we wouldn't be able to make the most of that time. So, and in fact, for example, data sharing is one of those key things that we think it's great to see that you're having data being shared with you from telcos, but it'd be very good if we should remember that financial institutions are mostly blind. We arrive at the last mile, okay? In the life cycle of the fraud, we are at the last mile, and I like to say, you know, we should be the last line of defense, but in reality, sometimes it feels like we're the only one, which shouldn't be the case. And in that moment, we're really blind to what happened before, and who this money is going to, and if we are able to access all the data from the beginning of the life cycle, we could probably stop the majority of fraud. So what I mean tangibly is, imagine there is a purchase scam happening, originated on some kind of online social media, because social media is where the majority of the frauds we see are originated. This probably is a repetitive scam. And the moment it arrives to us, it's just one of many. Yeah. And we have no line of sight of who is the kind of payor, so where the money goes, which probably is the same person that's already done it 10 or 100 times. And we have no visibility, I don't know, even on the URL of the company. So this is very simple data that if they were all shared across the board, in real time, the private sector would really act on it, right? So to answer to your question was, yes, it's very welcome, but it'd be good to ensure that we can use that time in a more productive way.
And Nick, you focus kind of heavily on the international threat here, and the government estimates that 70% of fraud has an international element. Given, as you said, the many, many different kind of call centres and organisations internationally that are doing this, what can the government or anyone do to tackle that? Is it not a case of whack-a-mole?
I think it's exceptionally difficult. And I really sympathise with law enforcement, because I think they're in a really, really difficult position, because the scale of this is so great. Actually trying to prevent it in traditional law enforcement ways, I think, is nigh on impossible. I wonder if a better approach is going to be having difficult conversations with governments of other countries and essentially trying to encourage them to disincentivise people from going into this kind of work. Because, for example, if you look at in India, they've got 15 million graduates who join the workforce every year with university-level degrees. They simply do not have the jobs to support that level of graduate employment. So a great deal of 18 to 25-year-olds, in a country, by the way, where 25% of people are vulnerable to extreme poverty, so I'm not judging them for doing this, do end up going into, for example, working in scam call centres. Is this a diplomacy situation where we need to have conversations with these countries and say to them, unfortunately, our citizens are being defrauded on an enormous scale by an industry that's being run almost exclusively from, in India's case, scam call centres. And there's plenty of other different geographical specialisms around the world as well, like Southeast Asia with pig butchering scams. There's plenty of romance scams coming out of West Africa. We're the number one in hi mum scams, which are the texts where it says, you know, hi mum, drop my phone down the toilet, contact me on this number. But I think we do need to look at diplomatic response to this, because I'm just not sure that, unfortunately, raiding call centres is going to be the answer. Because you raid one massive call centre, there's four managers, those four guys all go and set up smaller operations somewhere else.
Well, I'm glad we're a global leader in something, even if it is hi mum scams.
Yeah.
I'm going to open up to questions from the audience. So thank you for raising your hands. If I come to you, can you please wait until the microphone comes to you, say your name and organisation. Given what happened earlier, could you please make sure it is in fact a question about fraud? And could you also please make sure it is in fact a question and not a long statement? So I am going to come to three people at the front here first.
Thank you. Elizabeth Mistry from Protect, the UK's whistleblowing charity. We know that a lot of fraud, having heard about large organisations, also comes from SMEs. And should we not be starting at the basics? Currently, there is no requirement upon employers for a duty to investigate. When we're looking at reforms to the Public Interest Disclosure Act, would the panel support our call for all companies, large and small, to have a duty to investigate, to improve employer standards, and to actually find that this will help organisations show that they have a good defence against fraud? Thank you.
Thank you very much. This gentleman here, and then the lady there.
Thank you. Andrew Budd, CEO of London-based iProve. As a former non-executive director of an industry-specific anti-fraud organisation, I observed a strategy which said, follow the money. A number of industry commentators have remarked that the prevalence of fraud does not seem to be impeded at this moment by any ability of banks or law enforcement to follow the money through to the fraudsters who are able to take money out of the system. That implies a significant failure in our KYC regime. Surely if KYC measures were more effective, it would be possible to hold fraudsters to account. So my question is, particularly in a world of increasing pressure from deepfakes that are making the problem harder and not easier, do you see scope for public or agency interventions that would enhance Britain's level of KYC effectiveness to that of some other countries?
Sorry, for those who don't know, what's KYC?
Know your customer.
Thank you. And then later then.
Hi, I'm Katie Kemp and I'm Chief Executive of Victim Support. We very much welcome the fraud strategy focus on empowering and preventing fraud, but what we tend to find is that we end up picking up the pieces once fraud has taken place. So seeing some really devastating consequences of romance fraud, more kind of in-depth fraud where people have effectively lost their life savings and can't continue to live as they have previously. It's great to hear all of this. I would love to hear what your plans are for supporting people who have already been defrauded and are victims.
Great. So that's three excellent questions. What more can be done to support victims? What scope is there to improve know your customer measures? And should all companies, big and small, have a duty to investigate? Adrian, I'm going to come to you first.
I think the point on companies investigating ties into the question of whistleblowing and the sort of value of whistleblowing. And it's something which the new director of the Serious Fraud Office has called out as an issue he'd like to look at, so incentivization of whistleblowers. And certainly it's something from the NEC perspective we will work closely with him on, because a number of governments, I think, have also explored this, and there's challenges. It's not a straightforward thing to do, but I certainly see the potential merit. So I think it ties into the point that was raised. So we're very keen to look at that and see whether it makes a difference. On following the money KYC, in some ways it ties into the conversation about the challenge bank space, if they've only got a limited part of the picture. There are a number of initiatives in flight across banking, and you may want to come in on this, to share data better to be able to understand that flow of funds. You've got the likes of CIFAS, which is an agency that already shares some of the relevant data between banks. There are a number of initiatives in the NEC involved in one where we're looking at sharing more data between banks to help them spot some of these things. And then we have a broader challenge of some of the money muling networks, which enable a lot of these flows. And to be fair to the banks, some of those money mules, they are legitimate customers of the bank. They've just been exploited by the criminals to act on their behalf, and that's quite hard to spot for a bank. So there are a number of initiatives in flight. It clearly is an area, though, that needs more focus. And then lastly, on victim support, I totally agree with the point that there's more for us to do as a system to support victims. I know City of London Police, who from a policing perspective have a lead on this, are putting more resource into victim support networks across the UK. We're looking actually to bring together some of the protect work that goes on for cyber resilience centres into the same sort of mix with fraud, because a lot of the cyber and fraud threat overlaps. So recognise the challenge, there's more for us to do, but there are things that are beginning to happen.
Francesca?
Yes, maybe I'll start picking up the one on KYC, which is clearly a very key topic for us. So what I would say is the following. So in principle, yes, so the problem definition is correct. So it's very difficult to trace the money. And it's becoming increasingly difficult. KYC is quite advanced, the way people kind of, and the way we adopted, by everybody adopting the industry now. I think the there are two roadblocks when I look at real cases, right? So one is, which I'm not sure that directly linked to KYC, so it's more of a broad, holistic review of how it works. So one is the complexity of this transaction. So to your point about money moves and so on, and how fast they move. So typically one fraudulent transaction in like 24 hours has changed 10 bank accounts in probably 10 different names. So even if you were to do proper KYC, deeper KYC, anything on the initial person that opens a bank account, in reality that is just a screen, and behind that screen there are 10,000 other people. So it's too complex. I think we need to evolve beyond KYC, which is probably about holistic data sharing and ability to kind of go beyond what you're shown. The other thing that we notice in practice, and this is that there are today a lot of data privacy limitations as well, and GDPR and so on, which is of course very welcome. However, sometimes it slows down the machine. So even when we do have agreement with other banks or institutions about sharing data quickly, we are too slow compared to the speed at which the transaction, and by the time we are able to clear all our data privacy and other issues, then the money is already gone. So it's about the speed. So I think that's why slowing down a bit the payment helps, provided you have in place the other pieces of the puzzle in a way.
Emily.
I could talk for quite a long time on all of these things. So I'm going to try and edit what I want to say. Thank you for the challenge, Elizabeth. We've met, and I know there are a number of people who talk about why can't companies have a duty to investigate, or some people say why can't companies have a duty to protect. There's all kinds of sort of talk at the moment, and I think that's something that we need to think about quite carefully. But I think that we perhaps need to go further down the road in terms of getting some companies, and particularly social media companies, I think, to step up and take more responsibility. And if that doesn't work, then we might need to look at legislation. But, I mean, I think, you know, we need to take it sort of step by step, but I don't think they've been pushed hard enough yet. I think that what Andrew has to say about you know, how you catch the money as it moves so quickly through the system. I mean, there is another suggestion, and I don't know whether this is right or not, but, you know, if there was legislation, not just to give banks the powers to slow down if they think that there's been a fraud, but actually, would there be any mileage in us just saying, actually, you can't just press a button and money leaves your account straight away, that maybe you can't have it for 2 hours yeah. or a day? And if it was all the companies had to do it at that stage, but if we had at the same time some kind of strategy, some kind of agreement through the chain, you know, we are going to be passing information backwards and forwards, this is going to be okay, and then we can stop it yeah. in the time available.
Yeah.
That would be, I mean, if that worked, that'd be great. I mean, that would really help, you know. But I don't know if that would work, but that's the sort of thing that we need to do. I think organisations like CFAS do show us the way. It isn't just banks sharing information, it's all kinds of organisations, frankly, sharing, including local authorities, sharing information about people who's a fraudster, who isn't a fraudster, who you can't rely on, who you can. You know, this is what happens. It's going on. It's going on informally. It's going on between organisations. And it's going on, you know, in response to a different type of crime, but also in response to a feeling that law enforcement's not going to be able to provide all the answers or isn't providing enough of the answers. It depends who you talk to. But, you know, there is much more work, as I say, that can be done where organisations just insulate themselves by working together, I think, it's a 21st century response to a 21st century problem. I wonder how many people in this room have not this year had an attempt of fraud against them. So I wonder how many people here have not had a message, a telephone call, an email, you know, an attempt to try to, you know, bring them in and to try to defraud them. Because I suspect there would be hardly anyone in this room who has not been the victim of an attempted fraud, if not a fraud. You know, it is so widespread. And we don't actually talk about it. I mean, I now do. Whenever there's an attempt to defraud me, I put it on social media. And even particularly, I fell for one. You know, the old kind of like, not quite hi mum, but the, you know, post office here, we're going to deliver your parcel, but we need you to give us £2.30 to redeliver it. And I gave them my bank details before I what have I done? So I put it on Twitter and I said, I'm an idiot. You know, this is what has happened. But I know that, you know, many people are idiots. So that's why they do it, is because it works and they work out. And they're very clever about it. And of course, the horrible thing about the romance frauds and related frauds is that they're so manipulative and so clever. They will go for what your weakness is. And it may be because you're lonely, but it may also be because, well, there's a number of other things. They can just go for you because you're bloody minded. They wave something at you and you think, oh, I quite like that. And then they make it difficult to get it. And if you are of a character that's bloody minded, I'm going to get that no matter what, then you will end up going down the path with them. There are a number of character traits that they play on in order to defraud us. And we just need to be more open about that. You know, I think it's the first step, but it can't be the only step. You know, we have to then start, I think, you know, ensuring that there is more communication. I spoke to a relative of mine because I had been doing some fraud work and I was sitting at the dinner table with her. And she started to cry because she had been the victim of fraud and she never talks about it because she's so ashamed. We've all had this experience, I fear. You know, this is... And yet, if you're a burgled, you talk about it. So, yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I don't know what the answer is, but we need to be mindful of this and we need to work out a strategy for that as much as we need to work out a strategy for fighting fraud more generally.
Nick?
I'd like to pick up on what you've just said there, Emily, because this is an issue that's really close to my heart. I get about between 5 and 10 messages a day, emails, direct messages on social media, from people who have been victims of scams asking for my help because they basically don't know where else to go. And I think we need a national conversation about this because this is the last acceptable bastion of victim blaming. Yeah. One of the most common responses that I see on social media to my programs and to anything else that I do is people saying, how could they be so stupid? And people saying, that could never be me. And that is simply untrue for a start. That is just absolutely not true. If you haven't been scammed yet, it's not because you're too clever. It's just because the right scam hasn't caught you on the wrong day, essentially. Yeah. And to change that, we have to encourage people to be comfortable talking about this. We need to try and remove the stigma of victimhood. And the first way you do that is to say to the general population, stop being complacent about this. Stop thinking you're too clever to get scammed and stop expressing that opinion into the world. Because just by saying that, you're making those who have been scammed far less likely to A, talk about it, and B, to engage with the advice that is there. That is the absolute most important thing we can do for people who have been victims of scams, in my opinion.
Yeah,
and just on Andrew's question there about following the money, just to give an example of something that I've actually seen as part of the upcoming series of Scam Interceptors, we have investigated money mule networks. And this is what you're facing. Mm. A bank impersonation scam. A victim withdraws money as cash. They're told to post it to a mule address. They post it to somebody's house. That person, who, as Adrian said, might well be in an exploitative relationship with a scammer where they've previously been a victim themselves, and the scammer's said, you can have half of your money back and take 5% of future earnings if you do this for us. They take receipt of that money as cash. They go off down to their local branch of their bank, deposit the money as cash in the local branch, and then send it off to somewhere else, in the probably another account in the UK. That account then sends it off to somewhere else in the UK. That account then sends it off to somewhere else in the UK. By the time it's even left the country, it's been cash initially and then gone through 4 bank accounts. It then goes to a third-party country, interestingly, in my experience, usually somewhere in Eastern Europe, before going to Thailand and then eventually, in the case of all the scams I investigate, back to India. How on earth are law enforcement supposed to follow that? Especially when there is a disconnect between the amount of money lost by the individual, like, say, £4,000 or £5,000, and the individual's expectation. They think, to them, that's a life-changing amount of money. But the reality is, the scale this is happening on, to law enforcement, that's barely worth investigating because of that paper trail that's necessary to be followed. So I think that is one of our biggest problems as far as following the money is concerned. Unfortunately, there is a disconnect in expectation between the average person who loses money to a scam and what law enforcement is realistically going to investigate.
OK, I'd like to take another round of in-here questions. I'm going to take the 3 at the back there near you, Maddie.
Yes, thank you. Alex Rothwell, I'm the Chief Executive of the NHS Counter Fraud Authority. Maybe a question for Adrian first. What's stopping the National Crime Agency from taking over scam interceptors and doing ethical hacking and disruption at scale? Policing invests millions in preventing crime. Just ask the Millennium Dome robbers, for example.
Perfect. Thank you. And then there was a lady one row in front.
Thank you very much. Sonia Brown from Visa. We are reducing fraud on our network, so agree that technology can play a really important part in the lift here. But we should be under no illusions that criminals will always try to be one step ahead. The sharing of data is essential in order for technology to effectively work. Interested to hear the panel's perspectives on what more that we can do to help educate consumers on the importance of data sharing, not for sales and marketing and those types of things, but for the use of it in technology to combat fraud. Thank you.
Thank you. And there was one other gentleman there.
Robert Price from Comms Council UK. I'm quite interested in the data sharing issue and especially data protection that's been raised a little bit already. A lot of service providers find that it's a bit of a whack-a-mole situation where you can get rid of a scammer on your network, but they just pop up on another one. And they sometimes find that the data protection rules prevent the industry talking to themselves in order to prevent suspected but fundamentally not convicted scammers. What do the panel think about the balance of the rules between the protection of personal information and the responsibility on the sector to combat fraud?
Okay, so three excellent questions again. They're on the balance between protecting against fraud and protecting personal information. One on what more we can do to educate consumers. And then one for Adrian on why he's not putting Nick out of a job by doing scam interceptors himself. Nick, I might come to you first.
Sure. Please don't take my job. I really like it. I think it's very difficult, but I would imagine. I'll probably let Adrian take the lead on that one, but I think it's probably very, very difficult for a number of different reasons. What we do would be very hard to scale, I suspect, but I think I'll probably let Adrian take the lead on answering why that's going to be a problem. I would just like to, on the last question from Robert there, about the balance of data protection versus our ability to kind of combat fraud, I have personal difficulty with this because when we are filming the programme, I often try to report live fraud to, for example, high street banks. So I will call up their fraud reporting line and I will say to them, who I am, obviously, and then there's a live scam happening with one of your customers. Who can I report it to? Now, by this point, when I'm talking to a person, I've already had to pretend I'm one of their customers just to get through the automated messaging service to be able to talk to the first person in the first place. So we usually ask around the room, has anyone got an account with X bank? Mm. And then we just pump in those details to get through to an individual. Then when we're talking to that individual, they won't talk to me because of the fact that I'm not the customer. And I'm saying to them, you don't understand, this person is about to be defrauded, but you're unwilling to have a conversation with me about that. And half the time what I end up doing is just saying their name and their account number and then hanging up the phone. Because I know then the ball is in their court and they have to do something about it. But I do think that's a big problem. We need to have a bit more openness in terms of being able to actually deal with this without having that sort of computer says no situation where someone says you just can't do it.
Emily.
So I think that the question is an important one and one that we need to have together thought through what the answers are. I think that some of us of a certain age have been well aware of the public's reaction, at least then, to the idea of ID cards and how unpopular they might be. It's odd, though, that we seem to have a very different attitude to the state having information about us, to private sector having information about us. I mean, you know, Facebook seems to know about my passion for brightly coloured sports shoes. And yet, you know, and I seem to be quite comfortable about that. But it's so odd that, you know, we have given so much data in many ways, actually. And I think a younger generation has a different attitude. But I think that we have to also be quite honest about if you want to have certain services, then there has to be a certain amount of sharing of data. So, you know, if you want to be able to see a pair of sparkly shoes on Facebook and decide you want them now, and you press the button, then actually there really should be a bit of data sharing in order to make sure that you are protected. And so I think that the site ought to have some form of verification. There should be, you know, and that actually if you want to sell a pair of shoes, then you do need to give a bit of information about yourself to make sure that you're not a scammer. Duh. And that, you know, and if you want to be able to, and for that money to then pass, I think there has to be a certain amount of sharing. And if I'm defrauded, then, you know, and I ring my bank, then I probably ought to, before I'm able to get my compensation, to say, where did I, how did I get attracted to do that? Where was I? Did I go on Facebook Marketplace? Okay, you know, can I remember it? You know, give all the details that I can. And then that information, the information about me and my bank account and how much money I, you know, got defrauded from, will then be given in good faith to Facebook, who will then, you know, be able to close that bank account out. And there does need to be all of that in order for us to be... And it's just common sense. And I think if you start explaining that to people, then I think that people are more relaxed about it. But I do think that we have to earn people's trust. And I think at the moment, when it comes to the issue of fraud, we don't have people's trust. And frankly, I understand why.
Francesca.
Yeah, so I think data sharing is a hot topic. So what I would say is the following. I think the way I see it is that, or at least the way we see in practice, there are two levels, right? And we probably should distinguish the forest from the trees. So on one side, what would be helpful is to have, is when you talk about data sharing across sectors, like from social media companies to tech companies, telcos and financial institutions, that by itself doesn't need to include all the time PII data. So sensitive data. So even just being able to have a database where we know all the kind of businesses that have been flagged as fraudulent and so on, that by itself can be done without any exceptions, let's say, to the privacy rules. Now, there is a second part of the problem, though, and I fully agree, which is where things get stuck, which is it comes to a point where even in situations where there is a proven fraud that has been investigated and three other financial institutions or social media companies have been raising it, still, we cannot share the information of the next bank account where the money has gone through. That seems a paradox, apparently. So that is where I think there could be some regulatory intervention to almost have a trigger where in those situations we have a proven situation, then the benefit for the customer, the trade-off is, you know, a different balance. So you could have a carve-out or whatever, a different type of treatment. But it needs to be treated carefully because then it could open all sorts of other discussions. But I do think that, however, we should not think that all this, we can also share a lot of data right now without having any problem, right? And already that first step, we should take it. And I think that's all. In terms of education, I think we are a little bit, businesses are also a little bit the problem here, because historically, for many, many years, people have been told, share your data, and then they get a flood of emails. So I think the private sector, we should take responsibility, be more conscious about what we ask data for, and maybe signpost it. There's some of this data, some of them is legitimate, should be mandatory, completely agree. If you open a business, if you're doing something, you should be able to provide some information. But as a customer, as a consumer, maybe we could have different type of disclosures and signpost it very well. And then the private sector should have incentives not to abuse of that, of course. My 2 cents on it.
Adrian, final word to you.
Just briefly on the data sharing. I mean, there have been quite a few changes to legislation in the last sort of year or two. And I think we're now sort of testing the boundaries of how we can utilise those changes in some of our data sharing initiatives. And then on scam interceptors, in a previous life, I used to make TV documentaries myself. The ability to educate and entertain at the same time was something I was always aiming for. So I'm a real fan of scam interceptors because that's exactly what it's doing. But turning that into something which will impact the threat at scale, that is the challenge which Nick himself has called out. We are doing work. We have undercover online operations. We work with GCHQ. So some of these things we are doing, and I obviously can't talk in detail about it, but actually the strategic solutions are more along the lines of actually some other things that Nick mentioned. So it's how we work with our international partners to deal with the threat at source. I personally have been out in countries like Ghana, Nigeria, talking to them to work out what we can do. I'll be in India later this year. And then also there's the work with the technology sector themselves, what can we do around the infrastructure to reduce the vulnerabilities that these call centres and others are exploiting. So hopefully that answers the question.
Thank you. Sadly, with that, I'm going to have to bring the event to a close. Thank you very much to our 4 excellent panellists for what's been a really enlightening discussion, to Revolut for partnering with us on the event, and to all those who've attended today in person or watched online or are listening back later on SoundCloud or YouTube. Thank you very much.
Thank you.